Today's topic is one that we don't talk about often because it's painful.
Yeah. We're talking with Rachel Lewis today about infant and pregnancy loss, which, to be honest, I've not personally experienced. How about you, Amy?
No, I haven't either. But, you know, I know so many women who have experienced miscarriage and loss. And, you know, I think about our listeners, you know, I'm sure you have a daughter. If you have experienced it yourself, we just want to say that we're so sorry. And we know that what Rachel has to say today is really going to be helpful to you. But also, you may have a daughter or a niece or a granddaughter or a friend that's experiencing this. And I just in the past have felt so inadequate to really compassionately deal with other people's grief. So this conversation is fantastic.
Absolutely. You know, when I was younger and hanging out with young moms who were, you know, having, you know, children, I remember one particular woman who experienced a miscarriage, and I did my best to respond to her in what I was hoping was a compassionate way. I meant well, Amy. I really meant well. But I found out afterwards that actually I didn't help at all. And I actually kind of made things worse in trying to say something. You know, I felt so awkward and I thought, well, something's better than nothing. And then I found out that wasn't true. So it is so good to have someone here with practical experience and information to share with us.
Yes. And Rachel, having experienced it herself, is the exact right person to talk to us about this.
Well, this is Sherry Gregory.
And I'm Amy Carroll.
And you're listening to Grit and Grace, the podcast that equips you to lose who you're not, love who you are, and live your one life well.
Today, we're talking with Rachel Lewis, author of Unexpecting, Real Talk on Pregnancy Loss. Rachel Lewis is the founder of Brave Mamas, an online community offering support to thousands of bereaved moms. Rachel is a well-known contributor to Still Standing magazine and Pregnancy After Loss Support. She's the creator of Unexpecting, a four-week grief workshop for pregnancy loss for couples. Rachel has experienced the loss of 5 pregnancies, as well as the unique grief of reunifying a foster son with his birth family.
What to expect when you're no longer expecting? When your baby dies, you find yourself in a life you never expected. And even though pregnancy and infant loss are common, they're not common to you. Instead, you feel like a stranger in your own body, surrounded by well-meaning people who often don't know how to support you.
What you need during this time is not a book offering easy answers. You need a safe place to help you navigate what comes next, such as coping with a postpartum body without a baby in your arms, facing social isolation and grief invalidation,
wrestling with faith when you feel let down by God, dealing with the overwhelming process of making everyday decisions, learning to move forward after loss, creating a legacy for your child.
In Unexpecting, bereaved mom Rachel Lewis is the friend you never knew you'd need, walking you through the unique grief of baby loss. When nothing about life after loss makes sense, this book will. Rachel, we are so excited to be here on the launch day for your book, baby. Congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, there's so much celebration with you and for you on this day, but your book is about a really hard topic. Your book is titled Unexpecting, Real Talk on Pregnancy Loss. So tell us how this book came about and came into the world. Who are you writing this for?
I think initially I thought I was writing it for me. It turns out I wasn't. But I went through 5 pregnancy losses. And so the book is about basically what to expect when you're no longer expecting. I first conceived of the idea when I was walking through my 2nd pregnancy loss. I had gotten a call from the nurse saying that my HCG numbers had dropped and that this pregnancy would no longer be viable. And so I knew that I was going to miscarry, but my first loss was an ectopic pregnancy. And so this was a very different sort of experience. And I hadn't quite gone through a loss where I was anticipating the loss, if that makes sense. And so I just didn't know what to do. So my husband and I, we decided to go to the mall so we could walk around. I'd heard, you know, walking around can start labor. So I figured maybe it would start a miscarriage. And while we were walking, we stopped at Barnes & Noble and decided to just look at books and then maybe get a cup of coffee. And of course, my mind was solely focused on pregnancy loss. And so I wanted to find a book that would speak to where I was and actually help me understand what to expect, especially physically, because I got a call from the nurse, yes, but really the only instruction that I got that day was let us know if you bleed through more than one pad in an hour. So I just had this big unknown in front of me. And so we walked through Barnes and Noble. I searched the pregnancy section, which was incredibly painful, but that just shows you how desperate I was to find something that related to my experience. And then I also searched the grief section, and I only found two books that day that could sort of even slightly address my loss. And one of them was titled something infuriating, sort of like, you know, basically like how not to miscarry, which was just salt in the wound. And the other, which actually I love this book now, but like it's called Taking Charge of Your Fertility. And that's a fantastic resource if you are looking to try to conceive. But if you have already experienced a loss, it's hard because I was like, I tried to take charge and that did not work. So I just remember sitting there, you know, with my cookie and my coffee. And I just thought, you know, I'm going to write that book. One day there's going to be somebody who's going to walk in a Barnes and Noble. They're going to be in the middle of a miscarriage and they're going to need to know what to expect from their body, heart, mind, and soul. And so I want to write that book. And that was 9 years ago. And here we are today. It hits bookshelves today. So it's been kind of a long journey.
Wow. It sounds so needed. And you've already given us a hint that I think is so important, that it's your body, heart, mind, and soul, not just your body, which I think miscarriages are often dismissed. And so I'm so excited that you're handling this hard but needed topic.
Thank you.
Yeah. So speaking of the potential to be dismissive, we often think the measure of a parent's grief is directly related to how far along they were in the pregnancy. And I'll admit, I've either thought or said, oh, at least you weren't too far along. Like as I don't even know what I was thinking. It just came out my mouth. But you say there's more to the equation than we often consider. So what plays into how a person experiences the grief of pregnancy loss?
Well, what's interesting is that there's been quite a few people who have tried to do a scientific study to sort of prove that a later gestation loss is more devastating. And in spite of like all of these attempts at studies, really, it's not been able to find a direct correlation, which is really interesting. And I think for anybody who does have an early loss, who is constantly having to validate even internally their own grief, I think it's really helpful to hear science say that is, you know, may play a small role, but that is certainly not the defining, you know, role here as to how your grief might be related to your gestation. And so other things that can come into play would be if there's any kind of infertility involved, whether that is before or that comes after, and, you know, that's considered a second major loss. If there's any kind of trauma involved, which to be honest, for many people, the loss of a pregnancy is traumatic because it can feel like it's beyond their own ability to cope. For many people, you know, they want their body to protect their child. And here they are in a position where their entire body is not allowing them to. And so that can be a very, very difficult experience where you feel like you are unsafe or your baby's unsafe. And so that's can be a very traumatic loss. Things that can come into play are, how did you feel about your pregnancy? Were you excited about this pregnancy? What was your relationship like to this pregnancy? What were your hopes and dreams for this baby and for this pregnancy? What's your own personal history with pregnancy? You know, do you have a history of birth complications? Like there's just like, I mean, if you know, as I'm talking about this, you can just hear there's so many layers of complexity when it comes to this loss. And yet as a society, what we often long to do is just to put each other in these boxes and say, well, this was an IVF, you know, failure. So that's in a different box here than this 40-week stillbirth. And that's 40-week stillbirth is in a different box than this 41-week birth that resulted in death at birth. And that's different than this 3-month baby that died at SIDS. And so we like to have these neat, tidy compartments for grief when really that's absolutely not how grief, especially pregnancy loss grief, works.
Well, speaking of grief, I mean, one of the hardest parts of living in the new normal after losing a baby is experiencing grief triggers or these intense, unexpected bursts of emotion. So what are some ways a bereaved parent can handle an unexpected grief trigger in the moment? And how can they prepare to handle them in the future?
That is an excellent question. I think grief triggers can be one of the more challenging aspects of living in your new normal. I often said it felt like I was walking through an emotional minefield. I just had absolutely no idea when I would just have this very unwanted and an unexpected burst of emotion that would just, you know, completely derail me for a very long time. And so I found that for me, over time, I started to recognize sometimes I could start to predict what might cause that trigger. And so not all of the time can you predict, but when you can, what I found to be very helpful would be to come up with a plan. It's kind of like that, you know, how when we were all in elementary school, like they just say, stop, drop, and roll. Like you have a plan, you know what to do. So like if for some reason you were to ever catch on fire, which is actually funny because I think I walked around most of my childhood thinking this was a common scenario. At any moment, I could just be on fire. But just having that plan to say like, I know what I'm going to do in that moment. And so knowing to like leave the fire is if you can to get out of the situation, if you are able to. If you're not able to get out of the situation and if you're not able to avoid the situation altogether, how can you help tamper down the flames? How can you sort of ground your body, get your body on the ground, get your body present? So employ some of those grounding techniques. Take a look around you and see, you know, what are five things that I can see? What are four things that I can touch or that I can feel? What are three things that I'm feeling? What are two smells that I'm smelling? Or, you know, that kind of thing where you're just trying to get your body grounded and present and remind your body that you're safe. That is a really, really big component of it. Having a safe word with your spouse. So, or your whoever you're with to say like, this is a really heavy grief moment for me. You don't have to be able to communicate and a lot of words, but just have that safe word where you can say that word to your significant other and they can know, okay, we need to exit this situation, or this is no longer like a good situation to be in. Like, let me see how I can help you, or let me see how I can help address your needs. So those are just some, kind of some things if you're in the moment. And then again, planning ahead would be having that grief word with your significant other. If you know that you are going to be triggered by seeing somebody else's belly, maybe change the times you go to the grocery store. Maybe grocery shop when it's not, you know, prime time for every mom out there who's trying to get dinner on for the kids. Maybe you don't go to church in person for a while. Maybe you listen to, you know, the radio, or now that we're all live streaming, maybe you do something like that. Maybe you have a plan for when somebody asks you, like, how many kids do you have? So I would have a plan. I started saying, you know, at the time I just had one living daughter, and I just started saying, well, I have one daughter at home. And most people would not catch the at home. But for me, that was important because I could still acknowledge that there were babies in heaven and that, you know, that I still counted them in my lineup of children. But I also knew that I wasn't ready to be completely transparent with this person in front of me. I didn't want to have to address this. So I just sort of had these canned responses for depending on how I felt at the moment. And then two, recognizing like you don't owe anybody anything. So if you are triggered by grief and you're triggered by this trauma, like it is a biological response. And so you're not being too sensitive and you're definitely not being insensitive to the people around you. You are dealing with a body in which it is like you've started a cascade of events hormonally and chemically. And that's something that you have to and get to take time out and take time to address without layering that with judgment and shame as to why you just couldn't perform, you know, in that situation, or why, you know, why would that be triggering to me? Like sometimes we sort of try to shame ourselves into like saying, well, that doesn't make sense. Even in hindsight, I don't understand why I was feeling like that. But yeah, it's not something that we necessarily have control of. But when we make a plan for those as we can, we insert a little bit of control back into the situation. And even that in and of itself, having that control can help tamper down that trauma response a bit.
I love these practical ways to gain agency in a situation that not only feels out of control, but I would imagine feels like almost like your body has betrayed you and you're now stuck with a body you don't know if you can trust. So speaking of judgment and shame, you say that roughly 50% of the words that are said, quote unquote, in support of bereaved couples will actually hurt them. That's a really hard statistic to digest here. So would you share a few examples of words that can hurt and offer us some better options for friends and family members who are listening today?
Yes, I will definitely do that. And in my book, I have an entire chapter that's called Hurtful Words that goes through a lot of these common platitudes. I think the key with platitudes is that I'm going to put myself in the standpoint of a supporter. When I give someone a platitude, it's because I don't know what to say. I maybe am terrified of saying the wrong thing. So I default to something I'd heard, said to me. I just am so afraid of silence that I would rather fill the silence with anything than to just sit with the silence. And then I might feel pressure to make the situation better, because I hate seeing my loved one hurt. Like that can be one of the most painful things. We talk about trauma response and that, it's that lack of control and seeing somebody hurt. As supporters, we can look at somebody who's had a loss like this, and we might feel like this is a threatening situation. This is a scary situation. I need to fix this situation. And so these platitudes sort of jump out of our mouth. And I think the key to them is the fact that while we intend for them to support and comfort our loved ones, what it often does is it hurts our loved one, but comforts us. It makes us feel better. And that is a really hard thing, I think, when we are supporting, to recognize that our motivation, what we think that is to comfort that person, it really, in many ways, is to comfort ourselves. I think the idea is if we can't fix the problem, baby loss is an unfixable situation. We can't make anybody just go back and have, put their baby back in their belly or make the baby alive. It's not fixable. So then we try to fix the person. We try to fix their grief.
Ouch.
Right? Because we can't.
Oh, yes. I'm like, oh gosh.
Amy and I are both fixers. So we're over here squirming.
Yeah. Cause I'm thinking, how many times have I done this? Oh, keep going, Rachel. We need to learn.
Well, I mean, and it can be a really well-motivated thing. I mean, I really do say 99% of the things that are said well-intended.
Of course.
But when we tell somebody, when we try to give them a platitude, let me walk you through this. So let's say the platitude is, let's use the one, so at least you weren't so far along, just because that's the one that you mentioned, Sherry, not to throw you under the bus at all. This is a really, 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 really common thing to say. So then if we walk that, if we were to walk that backwards, if this loss is not as important, if we can diminish the loss because we can label it and say that it's early, then we can say, then you don't have to hurt so bad. And if you don't have to hurt so bad, then I don't have to hurt so bad, right? I can sit with you in your pain. And if your pain is less, then my pain is less. My discomfort is less sitting with you in that. I have a list of things in here, but anything that starts with at least is hard.
Don't say it. Yeah.
If you were to say something like God's will, this was just God's will. Jesus tells us to pray that his will happens on earth, which implies by default that not everything that happens on earth is God's will, right? But you wouldn't tell us to pray for that if it meant that just because something happened, it was God's will. And, really what are we saying when we say that it was God's will? It was that God somehow decided to implant a baby in your body and create a baby. And, for those of us who have grown up pro-life, like we've been taught how absolutely sacred this life is. And so then that person might turn around and say, well, at the loss of that life, well, that was also God's will. So God created a baby in me and then changed his mind. And all of a sudden now God decided, like, why put me through that? If it was God's will for this baby to die, why just not create the baby at all? Like if you just kind of logically play out what you're saying when you say those things, you can start to hear why that sounds so dismissive to the person on the other end of things. If you were to say, just be grateful for the children you have. Mm. Okay. If you were to lose a child, would you just be grateful, for the child? Or if you lost a parent, how about we say that? If you lost a parent and your parent passed away, would it be okay if someone said, well, just be so thankful that you have your dad? you know, yes, your mom just died but let's just be so thankful that you had your dad. Your dad and your mom, they're not replaceable, right? They're two different entities, two different relationships. So things are replaceable. People are not replaceable. I did offer a chapter. So I'm kind of going through thing by thing here, but I do have a chapter called How to Help a Loved One Through Baby Loss. And that's a freebie on my website, unexpectingbook.com. And what I'm doing in the chapter, so in the book, I kind of delineate all of these sayings and why they hurt and what you can sort of say instead. And if you're a griever, how you can respond when somebody says this to you, that sort of affirms the relationship, but at the same time is direct and says, this is why this is painful to me. But in the chapter that I offer, I recognize that for someone who is in the support role, they can be also easily overwhelmed because they may be emotionally engaged in this loss, while at the same time, they are terrified of saying the wrong thing on this hand. They so desperately want to say the right thing on this hand. And if I were to give this person just a super long list of things to not do and things to do, and they kind of find themselves tugged between like the two of those, terrified of making a wrong move on either end, like just that alone is going to be overwhelming. And I don't really feel like that is going to be the best way that a supporter is going to feel enabled and empowered to help someone else. So what I do in the chapter is I use this definition from Bessel van der Kolk. I don't know, have you guys heard The Body Keeps the Score?
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I know, it's such a good one. So, you know, he talks about true social support being this issue of reciprocity. And it's this issue of being heard, being seen, being held, and having a visceral feeling of safety. And Bessel van der Kolk says this is important because, as you know, as far as like looking at disaster responses around the world, social support is the number one thing that can make a trauma either like give them the potential to heal, or if a social support is lacking or is bad, it can further traumatize and set somebody back in their healing significantly. So social support and getting it right is absolutely important. So important.
So good.
Yeah. So, you know, talk through, am I seeing them? Am I hearing them? Am I holding them? Am I creating that visceral feeling of safety? Am I creating an environment in which healing is possible? So your job is not to heal. Your job is to create the environment in which healing can take place.
Really, really helpful. And I'm thinking about our listeners, Rachel, because we do have some younger listeners, and some of our younger listeners may be walking through a pregnancy loss or have walked through a pregnancy loss. But then a lot of us are of a certain age, like Sherry and I, where we have daughters who may be walking through this, nieces, women at our church that may be walking through this. So this is really helpful. Here's a question that I think sometimes we don't even think about, but do men grieve the loss of a baby as deeply as women do? And if so, how do they grieve differently than their partner?
So men actually do grieve the loss of a pregnancy. And that is often overlooked because I think, you know, as we're talking about supporters, a typical thing that somebody who is very well-meaning and wanting to support the family desperately, they may go up to the partner and say, how is Amy doing? Right? Like completely don't address the fact that that person is also grieving. And instead, so bypass that and just ask them to start coordinating the grief care for their partner. So that, as far as like society goes, pregnancy loss, it's somewhat considered a bit of an ambiguous loss, but it's also considered a disenfranchised loss. However, for women, we have a little bit more validity that's been given to our grief because our bodies are so affected. For men, it's almost entirely disenfranchised. And that is really, really complicated. For men, they also have to combat this Western society's ideal of what masculinity is. For instance, I go through in the book about what are some of these traits of masculinity that get directly challenged by pregnancy loss. One of them is men should have a response right away to a trauma or to a loss. Like they need to be the problem solvers and they need to be immediate with their ability to problem solve in the moment. And actually what studies have found is that men's typical, I'm not trying to like put it too much in a box, but generally men's response is this feeling of being incapacitated and frozen. And that is the most common response that men feel in the face of an overwhelming loss like this. But we don't talk about that, right? So men have this idea of what they should be. Like, I shouldn't be feeling this. I'm a man. I should be feeling, you know, all of these Western ideas of masculinity. And then we add that in that it's a disenfranchised grief. So they have fewer opportunities to talk to each other or to get support. And then we're going to throw on top of all of that, the fact that there's these two distinct grief styles that some study authors came up with. I don't say they came up with it. They uncovered it. They discovered it. And they put words to it to help explain the experience. So one of them is called an instrumental grief. And the other is an intuitive grief. Sherry, have I not talked to you about this yet?
My eyes just got really big, didn't they?
They did. And I was like, oh, I thought I talked to you about this.
New definitions.
Yeah, I know. You and I love these things. So instrumental grief asks, what do I think about the situation? And intuitive grief asks, how do I feel about the situation? Intuitive grief sort of wants to label emotions and it wants to reach out for connection and draw other people into that experience and to say, like, I'm looking for this connection here and we're going to talk about our feelings. And then intuitive grief says, I need to do something. I need to like viscerally transform my tears into sweat. And so one's on one side, the other's on the other. It's a continuum. All of us in our own grief style, we're going to fall somewhere on the line. Very few of us are going to be all one way or all the other. Men tend, so again, generalization, not applicable to everyone, tend to go more toward this instrumental grief of, I need to have this measure of control. I need to viscerally do something with my body. I need to have time to think about what I think about this loss and a lot less need to discuss feelings and discuss, you know, and connecting with other people necessarily through this loss. But when you think about traditional grief support, we really only address the intuitive, right? We tell each other, like, in order to process this healthfully, you need to gather in a circle with other people and you need to talk about your feelings. Like, that's what we say healthy grief support is. And so we're completely invalidating this whole other style of grief, which is as valid, like they've discovered it's as healing. It works the same purpose as this intuitive. They are on the same playing field, but our society is just not even prepared to embrace this style of grieving. So not only are we diminishing the loss, but we're also diminishing this entire style of grieving and we're not supporting that. Anyway, so those are just a couple of sort of ahas that I had as I was reading through the book. And then it just, as I sort of learned about all of this, I could see how this played out in my own marriage and my own partnership throughout our losses. And I was like, dang it, I wish I knew that before.
Sure. Well, this is really helpful for me because we've just had a loss in our family. And I'm just thinking to myself, I mean, the last thing on earth my husband wants to do is sit in a circle at all, you know, facing other people, let alone talk about feelings. So this contrast between what's expected and what's actual, I want to just pivot just a little bit here to the topic of our relationship with God when we're in loss. And you say that your faith in God took a pretty direct hit after you experienced the loss of your ectopic baby, Olivia. Could you share with us what you learned about asking questions and wrestling with your faith following the loss of your babies?
Yes. Well, I think as soon as, I mean, just very broadly speaking, if you're in the church realm or you're in the, you know, the Christian space, if that's kind of where you're at, there are all of these messages that have been ingrained about the role of loss in our life. And we often look at loss as a sort of test. For many, many years, I have degrees in Bible and theology. Even with that, for many years, I came to the book of Job and I sort of saw the book of Job as sort of this example of the perfect sufferer, right? Like we read through chapter one and we read that, you know, Job did not sin with his lips. And it was that, like, oh, I don't want to sin with my lips when I'm in the middle of a loss, kind of that feeling of pressure I'm already starting to put on myself, right? And we love his response so much. He says, you know, the Lord is given, the Lord is taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And we love that so much. Like we're like cross stitching it into pillows and we're like writing songs about it, putting memes on it. And we sort of fail to account for the fact that the book of Job is not over yet. Like we're in chapters 1 and chapters 2. There are 42 chapters to the book of Job. And if you're thinking, okay, you know, if we're coming to the idea of the Bible by saying this is God's written word for all of humanity throughout all time, and it is complete. If we know the reason in chapter 2, why Job suffered, and if he had the perfect response in chapter 2, and if there was nothing else to glean from Job, why in the world are there 42 chapters? That is a lot of real estate. If there's so few answers. And even in theology, like I was always just sort of taught like, well, there's a lot of questioning and a lot of going back and forth and a lot of conversation between Job and his friends, but really almost none of it is anything that we can particularly use because there's all of these truths and untruths and half-truths. And so, but it was just so confusing to me. I was like, well, why would God even include that? And I realized, you know, when all is said and done, by the end of the book of Job, Job had actually accused God of wrongdoing, right? He let loose his lament. And at the very end of it, through all of this questioning of Job and his friends, you know, more than like 38 chapters of this, at the very end of it, Job gets this response from God where, yes, it's not delicate and it's nice. Yes, it seems to be very direct. But at the end of that, God says, okay, let me show you who I am. And Job leaves that experience with a greater knowledge of who he is. Job actually says, okay, I had heard of you before, but now I see you. Now I know you. And that is enough for Job to say, I don't have any more questions. He never got the answer, but he just saw more of God. Whereas the friends who were so full of answers, they didn't have time for the questions. God had his harshest words. And they did not get to see more of God. You know, they were not included in this sort of revelation. They didn't leave this experience saying, I now feel closer to God. I now understand God. So for the longest time, I thought loss meant having the right words. I thought it meant having the right response and not sinning with my lips. And I thought it meant that I gave glory to God and that he would be more glorified, I guess, in the sense, if I just said everything I thought he wanted to hear, even if it wasn't how I felt. And what I realized is that instead, God was literally holding space for my wrestling. Like if we need to have a picture of how God holds space for us, like look at those 38 chapters in Job. See how much real estate he left for just the wrestling where there were no real answers. And I realized that God already knew how I was feeling inside. So if I were just to spout the words that I didn't mean, that would mean that I was trying to sort of placate God, right? If I had a relationship, let's say you and I had a relationship and there was sort of a spat between us, it would be a greater testament to the strength of our relationship. If I went to you and I was like, Amy, I need to sit with this for a bit. You really hurt my feelings. This is what you said. This is how it felt to me. And I need to process this. But I'm just going to trust that you and I are okay enough that we're going to make it through on the other, you know, to the other side of this. Then it would be for me to say, hey, Amy, everything's good. You know, we're fine. We're fine. Right? Because the relationship that doesn't have strength is going to be the one where you feel like you have to say, I'm fine. I'm fine. The relationship that is actually strong is the one in which you can be honest and the one in which you can say, I'm going to be direct with you and tell you exactly how I feel and how I think. And I'm going to just trust that we're going to make it to the other side of this.
That is such a great picture because healing comes in the wrestling and it doesn't come without the wrestling, you know, because if you and I were in a spat and you took that stance, we would never heal. It would always be there. So beautiful. So Rachel, there's so much here, but what closing words do you have for our friends who are listening about grieving in general and specifically about grieving the loss of a child?
For those of you who are grieving a loss, I would want you to know that you are not alone. Your feelings, whatever they are valid. They are real. You get to carry your grief however and however long you need to, that there's no test here. your loss is tragic. It's not a test, and you have nothing to prove to anyone or to anybody. The loss of a child in pregnancy is a very real loss. It is a death, and it is nothing less than a death. So just know that you're not alone. Know that you are being held, you're being seen, you are heard, and that those of us in the bereaved community, we are doing the best that we can to give you that visceral feeling of safety and support. And for those of you who have not experienced this kind of loss, I would say become grief literate. Become pregnancy loss grief literate. Because if you haven't had someone close to you yet experience a loss, hold on, it will be coming. They expect about 1 in 4 medically confirmed pregnancies to end in loss. And so, like you all were saying, maybe you didn't experience it personally, but maybe you're at the point in which your nieces or nephews, or you know, your grandchildren, or your children, these people may start having to experience this kind of loss. And so become grief literate. You could start with the chapter that I have, How to Help a Loved One Through Baby Loss. And then obviously I stand by my book. And so I would say, you know, read my book and find out what this experience is. And so just so you can become better prepared to be a true support, and so that you can be the kind of person that creates an environment in which healing is possible.
Become grief literate. Wow, that is such great practical advice.
Very, very practical. And you know, I think our friends will appreciate it if we tune in to really what Rachel said. And for those of you experiencing your own loss, we pray right now that Rachel's words have brought you comfort and made you feel not so alone.
Well, friends, we sure hope you've enjoyed listening to episode number 239 of Grit and Grace, the podcast, as much as we've enjoyed making it for you.
And we want to say a big thank you to Rachel Lewis, author of Unexpecting, Real Talk on Pregnancy Loss, and her publisher, Bethany House.
Check out our webpage at gritandgracethepodcast.com/episode239.
There you'll find this week's transcript, a link to order Unexpecting, Real Talk on Pregnancy Loss, and a link to Rachel's website, which has some great resources related to her book.
If you've enjoyed this episode of Grit and Grace, would you consider leaving us a review? You'll find a super simple video showing you how at gritandgracethepodcast.com/review.
Next week, we've invited Rachel Lewis back for our follow-up convo about her book, Unexpecting, Real Talk on Pregnancy Loss.
For today, grow your grit.
Embrace God's grace.
And as God reveals the next step to live your one life well,
we'll be cheering you on.
So take it.